with a monthly pledge of $22.50, we will exceed the goal today. $540 to go. 800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org. This is your station for jazz and justice. This is your independent grassroots media outlet, and you make everything here possible. 800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org. Keep the calls coming for Democracy Now! And now for On the Margin, you are tuned to WPFW Washington.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Zelda Ecolia Irby. Zelda Ecolia Irby is the author of Spilled Tea Tastes Better, Cools Bitter Sweet. This book is a memoir that was published last year. How are you doing this morning, Zelda?
I'm fine, Ethelbert. How are you today?
Okay, well, you're joining us as we're having a fundraiser here at WPFW. And so we'll be encouraging everyone who's listening to you and us, actually, today, to call 202-588-9739. That number is 202-588-939 or 1-800-222-9739. Zelda, this Saturday, the F. Scott Fitzgerald Festival is being held in Rockville, Maryland at the Montgomery Community College. The special guest will be the writer Percival Everett, who is the author of novel James. Each year, Zelda, I teach a memoir workshop at the festival, and I ask the participants two questions, which I'm going to ask you.
Okay.
Because you've written a memoir. and the two questions are very simple questions, but very important questions. What can a person learn from your life, and what have you been a witness to?
Oh, wow. Those are interesting questions, Ethelbert. What any individual can learn from my life is, after they have read my book, Spilled Tea, they can find out some simple things about themselves, in my opinion, and that is to trust in your gut feeling, regardless to how old you are or how young you are, because every time I have experienced, every time I went away from that gut feeling or diverted my attention to doing something else, I always had to reset. Mm-hmm. And resetting is not a big deal. It gave me comfort each time I had to reset. Of course, at sometimes when I was very, very young, going on 80 years old now, I did not realize that I was resetting, but I knew something was different. But as time went on in my life, I realized that because I had diverted myself from what I thought that I should have done or what I should have done in the first place, I should have stayed on that path. So that's one thing that somebody can learn about me, or after having read a copy of Tea, is resetting is a positive step in your life when you're going forward. At least that's what I believe. And I know it from experience because I have written some words and some paragraphs, which are now a book.
Right.
That leads me to believe that resetting is a very good thing. At least it's been very good for me.
Now, you've lived in the city for a while, so there's a lot that you've been a witness to.
Yes. Being born and raised in Washington, D.C., at Freedmen's Hospital, February 14th, 1947. Into the wonderful hands of a physician.
I'm glad you said Freeman's Hospital.
Yes. And because, of course, it's no longer there. But being raised in Washington, D.C. all of my life, and, of course, as I got older, then I moved around into states like Maryland and Virginia, even as far away from, as far away to Florida and back home again. So D.C. is where I belong.
Mm-hmm.
But well, I've seen so many changes.
But I was going to ask you about that. You know, I mean, how do you feel about the changes? And what were some of the specific neighborhoods that you lived in?
Well, I lived off of South Dakota Avenue, 2909 26th Street, which was, we used to refer to it as Lightning Park. Some people still call it Lightning Park now. Some people call it Chuck Berry because the park has been renamed for him very nicely. But I have seen so many changes in Washington, D.C., you know, going to Woodbridge Elementary, to Taft Junior High, of course, to the Great McKinley High School. But just riding around, not often now, but I can get lost going into D.C. now because the place has changed so much. And it's beautiful, but, of course, it's just so many changes, some very, very good, some positive, and some quite challenging. But
you say challenging, although it sounds like there's a little sadness in your voice. What do you miss? What has changed?
Well, one of the things that I missed, because you know, as I've said, and I will say it a few more times before you and I leave each other today, growing up in Washington, D.C. used to be a safe haven. I could go northeast, where I grew up in northeast. I could go to southeast. I could go to northwest. I could go anywhere in Washington, D.C. I wanted to, riding the bus. I used to catch the crosstown bus to go to Kalorama Road to skate every Sunday, and sometimes on Wednesdays when it was ladies' day, ladies' night. But it's just, it just doesn't seem as safe to me now as it used to be when I was growing up. And I never was concerned about anything. And I don't know whether that came with my youth or just being comfortable being outside. And we stayed outside until the lights went on. Of course, when the lights came on, you went up to your steps, to your porch, into your house, because you didn't want your mom or dad coming to the front steps calling your name, because that was so embarrassing. And they let everybody let your friends know, right, how stupid you were, because, you know, when the lights came on, that was the signal to get your buns inside the house, because still the house is a safe haven. But I always felt safe in D.C. But when I go into D.C. now, I'm kind of looking around. I can't run as fast as I used to if I have to get out of the way. But the place was beautiful when I was growing up, and I have so many fond memories of growing up.
Well, you know, you mentioned in your,
you know, to right, just walking down the street, going to the right.
Well, you know, you mentioned in your book that one of the reasons for writing a book was that this was on your bucket list. You know, why did you want to write a book? Why did you want to write a book?
I wanted to write a book, believe it or not, Ethelbert, since I was a child. I used to write, and I used to want to be an artist. And I still, my artistic abilities still show up in my life, because I wanted to be an artist, but my father kind of directed me to go in a different direction, because he told me that artist people starve. And he said, Zelda, you liked to eat too much. And I said, well, okay, Daddy. But my point is, I wanted to write this book because I had things that I wanted to share. I had stories and experiences that I thought that might lift other people up who have helped me, not only from a spiritual perspective, but my teachers. I have teachers that I refer to in my book, my fourth and fifth and sixth grade teacher. She was a wonderful person. My clergy, who has gone on to heaven now, but Father West was wonderful. All these people in my life, including my parents, of course, but my campfire girl leader, so many people that I have met along the way when I was a child growing up, helped me become the person that I am today. And I think that I'm a very wonderful human being.
Well, I was curious as to what else is on your bucket list. Okay, you got the book out. What else is on the bucket list?
Well, one of the things that I like animals. And if you read, when you read my book, you can see that I talked about Ralph the turtle, who I saved. But I want to go to Tanzania one of these days before I go on to the other side, because I'd like to see an elephant sanctuary. That would just tickle my fancy. And I used to like to travel. I don't travel as much as I used to, because I just don't think that it's a good idea right now. So there's certain things on my bucket list. Writing tea was one, because I wanted to share my experiences with people, as well as traveling a little bit more. But I just have to wait and follow my gut feeling to decide when I'm going to go, because I've learned to follow my gut, because I feel more confident when I do that. Right. And I like being balanced.
Right. Well, I'm certain there's some people who are following the guts who are listening to us right now, and we're encouraging them to, continue listening and to support our station. The call 202-588-9739, 202-588-9739, and make a pledge. Zelda Irby, I was wondering, in terms of this first book, what obstacles did you have to overcome, and who gave you help, and who were your first readers?
Wow. Those are interesting questions. First, I had to learn how to discipline myself, because when I have ideas, let me speak for myself. When I have ideas, I write them down. And sometimes I go back and review what I have written down. Then I have to scratch it off, and then I have to make another list. So I'm always writing lists or writing something. I've got stickies all over my desk. But I do that because I want to try to stay on target with where I am in my life now. And sometimes being creative, I think the Lord has blessed me with the creative gene, despite I'm aging. But from wanting to be an artist, I still think that I'm an artist. I used to be a singer. I don't sing as much as I used to, because I just don't. And I'm one of those individuals. I'm a critic of myself, as I criticize other people with love. Mm-hmm. But when I used to sing, I could sing. Some when I can't hit a note anymore, I leave it alone. Mm. So,
I'm going to bring you back to the writing, because I know you sing, and we'll get into that a little later on in the program.
Okay.
But I was just wondering, in terms of, okay, you have this, you want to do this book, okay? You just don't do a book.
But I had to, because I've been wanting to do it for so long. And when I was growing up, I used to you remember the black and white Marvel composition books that we used to have.
Right, those little notebooks, yeah.
Yeah. And, I used to get one. Well, we used to get, my brothers and I used to get like five or six for just the whole year. But I would always ask my dad or my mom if I could get an extra one. And I used to get an extra one, but I was writing and drawing in that composition tablet. And I used to hide it, because those were my secrets. And then, to make a long story short, I had a nice little stack, and I had hid them in a place that I thought that was safe. And one day
let's stop right there. Okay. You're writing, and these are those your secrets. Okay. Now, this is why many people don't want to write a memoir, because they don't want to share their secrets. Okay.
And so I didn't want to share mine, but I wanted to write them down. But I used to always, when I would write something, Ethelbert, I would always have a picture to go with it. Mm-hmm. Because I liked crayons, I liked coloring pencils, but then I had this ribbon, and I would tie it up, and I would hide this book, my first one, and of course all of them. But then when I went back to look at my stack one day and try to, recapture some moments, they were gone. Mm. And I was like, oh my goodness, my mother or my father, because my brothers would never have done anything like that.
We know you sang, we'll get into the singing, but okay. I was wondering, in terms of writing, did you write any like poems or songs?
Oh yeah, I used to write poems all the time. I used to do that. That was one of the things that I enjoyed, but then I kind of stopped doing that, because when I would go back and reflect and read them, I said, well, that doesn't make any sense. So then I kind of turned those poems into pages that I was writing later on as I was putting my book together, because I was writing those poems because they had some significance. They may not have made.
So how come you didn't produce a book of poetry before the memoir?
I don't know, because it was difficult. When you have this dream and you want to give it legs and you want to mm-hmm. give it oxygen to live, when you don't have the right connections, or you don't know how to make those tap into those networks, those things can kind of set you back. At least they set me back. And it was the way I found my publicist. Was I had visited my daughter and was in this coffee shop, and the coffee shop had a little bookstore adjacent to it rather. And I went over there in this bookstore, and I just was amazed. And I saw somebody's name on a book who I remembered. And I said, why didn't they tell me that they had published a book? But to make a long story short, the person did tell me that they had written a book through my daughter, giving me the information. I just forgot about it. So I contacted her publicist, and that's how I was able to get my dream of writing my book into reality. Because when you don't know the roads to travel to get to bring your dream to life, sometimes people leave this planet and they don't.
So what you're saying for those of us who are listening to you right now is that there's a key point of just networking.
Absolutely. That is so key. When you have a network, and I even write about it in my book just a little bit, how significant networking is, because that keeps you connected to people. And even once your dream has come to life, that networking that you have done can be restored. You can build on it. A whole lot of wonderful things can happen when you network. I know that from experience.
Right. Well, my network group
was older than me. So of course they have gone on to glory. So I had to find another way to network with younger people. Mm-hmm. And my publishers was just absolutely fantastic, but I had to learn how to be disciplined. I had to learn how to actually stay on track.
And what did you learn from these young? What did you learn from these younger people?
Oh wow! Oh, that was a regrouping experience altogether because some of them don't have the same kind of level of honor and respect that I have for my elders. So I had to regroup to be in contact with these people and stay in touch with this group of youngsters, if you will, because they are deserving to have and speak their mind the same way that I had the privilege to and desire to speak mine. I was just fortunate enough to always be, first of all, I was fortunate enough to have my parents and have all those other wonderful people who allowed me not to get popped in the mouth for speaking my mind, because sometimes I did get popped in the mouth because, when your parents tell you can do something, particularly with my dad, he always told me, he said, Sassy, you can express yourself. He said, but just be sure when you do, you have respect for your elders. And so that's what I had to get together in my headspace when I'm talking to young people, because the young people, when they're talking to you, they really mean well, but sometimes they growl and their growl just kind of sets me into a different space, and I have to regroup so that I can continue talking to them and get an understanding,
Right. Well, Zelda Irby, there are different types of memoirs, and I felt your book is more what I would call the family memoir. And the reason why I say that is that I was just wondering whether you were targeting this audience. Your target audience was primarily family and friends. And the reason why I say that is because you have 14 pages in the back, like a nice collage of pictures, the back of your book. But I said, this must be family because I don't know who some of these people are. So it felt like it was a family gathering, where I know that sometimes the people do a memoir and they label who these people are. But I felt that your book was one that was like, okay, I'm going to have this for family members. When they open it up, they're going to see themselves in the collage in the back. They might buy 5 more copies. but I feel it was a family memoir.
Yeah, you're probably right, because I'm so close to my family. I grew up with them. And the people in my family, my aunts, uncles, I not only had aunts and uncles, great aunts and uncles, I had great, great aunts and uncles. So people on my mother's side in particular lived a very long time. So when I was a child, I grew up in a celebratory environment. So there was always somebody celebrating something, at least a birthday party. Mm-hmm. And not including those people's pictures in my book, I would have been completely out of kilter not to have included them. Mm-hmm. And then my family adores me for so many reasons. But one, I used to keep them up to date with our pictures from whatever was going on in our lives.
Yeah, you have a lot of pictures in the back of the book.
So they could see it the whole year of our activities that we shared with each other. So family is very important to me to this day. And I love the pictures I have so many collages, and I put that one together. It took me about 3 weeks to put that one together because I was pulling from so many other different collages that I had created over a period of time. And as you can see, I even have my great-grandmother's picture in there.
Right, yeah.
So I go all the, and the history of pictures is important to me because one of the things that my mother did when we were growing up, she took pictures of us when we were children. So I have all those pictures. I have pictures of me when I was an infant. And up until, you know, she just stopped taking pictures. And of course, I developed that hobby of taking pictures with our family everywhere we went. And then some of my family, not only my family, but my friends, they would know at any activity was going on, I would have the camera. So I would always be able to capture those historic moments of whatever we were celebrating. And I would share those moments in a hard copy with a note to my friends or family. Remember this?
Well, you know, when you say that, Zelda Irby, that's key. Like, you know, I always tell people sometimes in workshops that one of the things to do when you're working on a memoir is to gather up photographs because many times those photographs can trigger a memory. And sometimes it's reading the photograph. Like all of a sudden you look up, people are standing in front of a store that's not there anymore.
Yeah,
you
know?
Right. Right. So you don't have that. But let me move into something which I feel is very, very important. It's very sad, but also very timely. You work for the federal government for over 31 years.
Yes.
And we know that right now the federal government is closed. People have been losing their jobs since the beginning of this year under this administration. And I was just wondering in terms of, because you worked for 31 years, I mean, you may have still friends who were working in the government, but I'm just wondering in terms of how you see and how would you, if you were still working, how would you adjust to this particular time in terms of having a job?
Well, it's interesting that you would ask that because when I worked in the federal government, one of the presidents, President Ronald Reagan, came in and we had a massive reduction in force. And there were so many people who lost their jobs. And when I worked, I was in an environment where people were coming to me because my area of work was supposedly a comfort zone. And I could tell people by regulations and the rules and the standards of what they could do, what their rights were, so on and so on. But compare that today, it's just heart-wrenching to see what's going on because the reduction in force is completely different from what's going on now. And I had worked in 7 different agencies. Some people work in the federal government and they work in one agency for their entire career. Well, people can work wherever they want to work. But the reduction in force that I experienced was nothing compared to what's going on now. And it's just amazing to see so many people's lives actually being completely disrupted as a result. You know, you cannot, as my father told us, me and my brothers, you can't live in this world if you don't have a job and you have some money or somebody leaves you some money. Because money is a part of our society. You have to have it. And most people have money, have it through some means of working to support themselves, but it's completely different. And in another time when I was working in the federal government, there was can you go back to May of 1980 when there was the very first shutdown. So that's been 45 years ago. Compare that to what I experienced in government, reduction in force. And then I worked for an agency that was not appropriated by Congress. So I still had to go to work. Of course, I still got paid because I didn't have money coming from the federal government. But being furloughed, not getting the money that you have already worked for and earned is unconscionable to me. I think it's horrible.
What advice would you give people right now based on what you experienced, what you've seen?
The advice that I would give somebody today would be something that I would have told them a long time ago before today, is to have an extra plan, because I not only worked in the federal government, but prior to that, I always had 3 jobs, because you have to find a way to take care of yourself. At least that was the environment that I was raised in. I was raised in an environment where you had to be comfortable within yourself, making the decisions that you were going to make. And if you made bad decisions, then consequences came with those choices that you made. So I would tell somebody today that if they had a plan B, if they don't have a plan B, to create a plan B, create a plan C, but to always have something to fall back on and try not to be discouraged, no matter what environment you're in, whether you got furloughed, you lost your job, but you have to regroup, you have to reset. Once you reset, I think it's important that you can have a clear head and you can think about the direction that you want to go in, but you can't just sit there and just rot on the vine and fall off, because, you know, when you think about it, who's going to care?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you just gave us good advice for those of us who are listening, who are clinging to the vine, you know, the opportunity to show you also how important, you know, sometimes radio and this station is very, very important in terms of WPFW, sometimes being a lifeline to a community. Absolutely. And so once again, I encourage people, you know, who are listening to what you're saying. I know it might be difficult because somebody might have lost their job, but still it is important to support WPFW. And the number here to call is 202-588-9739, 202-588-9739. Or 1-800-222-9739. My guest today is Zelda Ecolia Irby. Where did that middle name come from?
My father used to tell me, because I asked him, I said, Daddy, where did Ecolia come from? He said, that's something that you will never know. He said, just know that I like the name and I wanted it to be your middle name. He said, I really wanted to be your first name. He said, but your grandmother won that battle.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll take a little break right now and come back. And I want to ask you some other questions that I think will be important to our listeners. You're listening to Zelda Ecolia Irby, the author of Spilled Tea Tastes Better, Cools Bittersweet. The show's on the margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Is your social justice calendar for the week of October 13, 2025. On Thursday, October 16th at 6 p.m. at St. James AME Church, 588 Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Newark, New Jersey, there will be the 30th anniversary commemoration of the historic Million Man March. For more info, visit njpop.org. On Thursday, October 16th, from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m., there will be an hour of quiet reflection and restoration for social justice fighters in the community at Seekers Church, 276 Carroll Street, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info, email sandra@seekerschurch.org. Friday, October 17th at 6:30 p.m. is the DMV launch for the historian Gerald Horn's latest book, The Capital of Slavery, Washington, D.C., 1800 to 1865, at the Cultural Arts Center of Montgomery College, 7995 Georgia Avenue in downtown Silver Spring, Maryland. More info is at eventbrite.com under Gerald Horn, The Capital of Slavery. On Friday, October 17th, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., Sankofa Books and Videos presents Copaganda, a book discussion related to how police and the media manipulate our news. It's located on 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest, and for more info, visit sankofa.com. On Sunday, October 19th, at 7 p.m., there will be Sudan on Our Mind, a bi-weekly community gathering discussion located at 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest. For more info and to register, visit sankofa.com. WPFW's social justice calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of our event. Donate to our Fall Pledge Drive by calling 800-222-9739 or donating at wpfwfm.org. WPFW's social justice calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, Zelda Ecolia Irby, and we're talking with her about her memoir, Spilled Tea Tastes Better, Cools Bittersweet. Zelda, let's go back about the federal government. Talk about blacks in government. You talk about that in your memoir. They just had their 50th anniversary back in March of this year. How important was that organization? How important is that organization?
Oh, that organization, when I was working, was a powerhouse. At least that's what we referred to it as, because anybody who was an African-American human being who worked in federal government, who was not a member, made it their business to become a member, from your top management all the way down to the support individuals. And it was such a powerful organization, because you had individuals from all aspects of federal government coming together in some kind of workshop, some kind of conference, exchanging their ideas. And during that time, the presidency, though, may have been Republican, it could have been Democrat, but there was a mixture for that whole period of time, because 50 years is a long time when you're working, you know.
Right.
We had so much collaboration. We had so many wonderful ideas and so many wonderful programs that encouraged young people behind, because, I mean, I was relatively still young at that time, but we had a group of, you know, the cross-section, excuse me, was fabulous because of the level of respect, the level of honor. When you look at the people who were in power at the time, for an example, after the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated, our government agency started a commemorative commitment for Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. We used to have breakfasts every year, and not only just on his birthday, but there were activities and programs that were developed that reached out into the community to bring people together to help them be aware of their own history, not only Black history, but to know the importance and the significance of the power of moving forward, not only with your history moving you forward, but for
what it seemed to me,
not to be knowledgeable about. Right.
Brazil, it seemed to me that an organization like this would be in a crisis right now because of what's going on.
Oh, it is. From what I've seen, but when I was working, we always had something positive. And the thing when I say positive, senior management was involved in everything that we did in Blacks in Government, because we were able to take it to them. And I guess they say, well, we're going to have to deal with these Black people, because we were not a group of people who just said, when somebody said, well, you can't do this, we would not leave until we came to get what we wanted. And when we left those offices, we walked down the halls, those marble floor halls, we went in there with an agenda and we came out with results. And I think what happens is when you have people working together in that team effort, you got to come away with something. You're just not going to come back out of the room empty handed. And we never came out with empty hands. Mm-hmm. You know, we always had something to give back to the community. And I can show you pictures. I can show you programs, because I kept every MLK junior program that we had, because we had people from all the way from Jesse Jackson, Fannie Lou Hamer, the Reverend Jesse Jackson is still with us, but a lot of those people who would come be with us in our offices, they were powerhouses back in the day, and we called on them to come, they came, they showed up, and we took them to the powers that be. Mm-hmm. And so I'm also convinced that when we went in with an agenda and came out of the room, we had the prizes of what we wanted to present. And those programs, some of them still exist, some of them have died. But the way that you keep a program going in the community is that you have to get your people in the communities involved. You can't let the people in the community say, well, you know, I'm taking care of my grandchildren this week, or we're going on vacation. You have to present something to make them want to hold on to that, whatever it is that will sustain itself, keeping that community and those individuals alive, because we're going to always be passing through this world. So you need to leave that door open behind you to let those young ones come through there and be strong enough, be willing enough to do the same thing and leave their mark as you left.
Let's take you back in time, Zelda Irby. Let's take you back to when you were 14 and 15. So talk about Teen-O-Rama, because Teen-O-Rama was big from 1963 to 1970. You know, talk about Teen-O-Rama, because I know there's probably some people listening right now who are probably participants.
Teen-O-Rama Dance Party was fabulous, as the kids now today say, was the bomb. But when your grades were good and were respectful, you could, you know, your parents would let you go up there and you could dance. And Bob King was wonderful. Mr. Tex Gathering, who did the filming. And of course, we as youngsters, we had a wonderful time dancing together, communicating together. But Teen-O-Rama Dance Party, I used to look forward to that. And when I got a chance to do one of the commercials, the Sandwich Long commercials, that was so much fun. But
you're saying you were a star is what you're saying, right?
Well, some people would say that. My parents would say that. My brothers and my daughter would say that. So I would agree.
So you were really, I mean, I know you could say you were a really good dancer then also.
Oh, yeah. And I still dance. I still love to dance. I don't dance as much, but I used to love to dance, you know, all the, you know, from the twist to the bop to,
What was your signature dance? What you did really, really good that people know you for?
Oh, my signature dance was hand dancing. I loved it. Dance. I bought some shoes as I got older when I could afford some dance shoes when I would go to a party. This was after, of course, Teen-O-Rama Dance Party. I would dance in those shoes because I could spin around on the floor, whatever floor it was on. You know, it was, those are my dancing shoes, but Teen-O-Rama was fabulous. I loved it. And I love Beverly for writing her, doing her documentary about it, because that was a wonderful time in my life. And when I drive by there, book 100, you know, on the right hand side, and I can still see the building still standing, it tugs at my heart. And I'm like, boy, those were some good old days.
Well, it seems like the hand dance is coming back a little bit.
Oh yeah. I've noticed that the young people are dancing. Doing the hand dance, because it's fabulous. It's a form of exercise. Of course, we didn't know we were exercising, but we were just having fun. And it's a beautiful art, you know. I have a couple of my cousins who went to hand dance in school. And I said, my first partner was, when my brothers weren't home, was the side wall in the kitchen. So I could push on the side of that wall and do my turns. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, talk about the Durrells.
Oh, wow. That's something that, well, Beverly.
How did that start?
Beverly, Renee, Janice, it was the four of us in the very beginning. And I get emotional because although it's been so long ago, we used to just sing a cappella anywhere. We would, when the four of us were together, we could hit a note, and because we enjoyed it, and we liked each other. We were young girls.
Did you also have steps and stuff? Did you have like steps and stuff?
Oh yeah, we had choreography. Yeah. We did our own thing because we had that camaraderie.
We did our own thing, and then everybody just copied from us.
And the harmony that we had was just wonderful. You know, it was just fabulous. So Beverly, who later renamed herself Shatir, just recently passed in September. But I don't know where Janice is, but Janice Rogers is a wonderful human being. As far as I know, she's still on earth. She wrote a song entitled Young Fool for me, especially, that allowed me to win, to be one of the first runner up for our first activity of Homecoming Queen. I wasn't queen, but I was the first runner up. But I won the competition because Janice wrote that fabulous song for me. And my voice allowed me an opportunity to express it. So
let me ask you this. So, you're dancing, you got a hit, people probably know you in the neighborhood. Is there a thing where you say, okay, how far can I go with this?
Oh, yeah. After we recorded our second record, we recorded five records, but only two of them made it out into the world. But when I realized after high school that we were not going to, you know, we used to have dreams. We used to sit in each other's basement and talk about going downtown to Greyhound bus station, getting on the bus and ride, going to Detroit. And we would just, after we would say these things out into the universe, and then we would look at each other and just start laughing. Because we were all daddy's girls.
Right.
Each one of us had two brothers. I still have mine, praise the Lord. But, you know, I realized that I had to take care of myself. I went back into those fundamentals that my parents had taught me, and just singing around in the district, you know, at the Hollywood Club, Shea Maury's, you know, places like that. And I was like, nobody's going to come in here. And because by this time, Beverly had gone to college, and Renee was on the circuit to a degree. She was entertaining. But when I realized, it just slapped me in the face one day. I said, girl, you got to get another real job and take care of yourself. So singing was just became a hobby. And of course, I sang in church, because I started singing in church, I think, when I was about 5 years old, because my mother said, told Father West, she said, my daughter can sing and I want her to have a solo. I don't want her just in the choir. I want her standing at the mic by herself. And I said, Mom, she said, I want the church to hear you sing. And I said, Mommy, please. And of course that happened. I was singing in church as a solo. So. Mm. Well, this, and of course, and still with the choir.
Right. Well, let's talk about the church, because one of the things that's throughout your memoir, you know, is your faith. Like that comes across almost on every page. And so I'm wondering, in terms of, one, did you ever have a sense of doubt? Did you ever have something, events that renewed your faith? You know, and then how does the faith capture on in terms of writing about it?
Well, it was interesting because being raised in an environment with my family, my mother and father, my mother was Episcopalian, my father was a Baptist. So every Sunday morning, there was some kind of, not feud, but question about where me and my brothers were going to go to church. So, of course, my mother won out over a period of time. My brothers became acolytes. And, excuse me, to make a long story short, we became Episcopalians because my mother had the power to be the woman that she was, and my father just yield to her and said, okay, your children can be Episcopalians. But I always knew, because my father was a tenor singer, he had a fabulous tenor voice. My mother was the solo voice, so every Sunday one of them was singing, but most of the time it would be my dad singing. So we grew up with the spiritual, not only knowledge, but hearing it talked about, or either hearing it in song. My grandparents, my great grandparents, and my aunts, my family, and period, was about spirituality and talking about the power of God. And so I know that through all of my ups and downs in my life that I have experienced, my safety net was God the Father Almighty through the blood of Jesus Christ. I know that. And I'm a product of that, and a miracle, if you will, because I'm still here and I'm talking to you and I'm telling you about it. Mm-hmm. So I know it's confidential. It's not confidential. It's a fact that I know that there is a God. I know that Jesus was real. He died for me. And I can attest to that because of the experiences and all some of the decisions that I made were not good ones. The consequences came to me, and to be loved after I've suffered some consequences, I know that the love came from not another human being, but from a source greater than myself that I certainly appreciate, love and adore to this day, because I'm still here, as I said a few minutes ago, sharing it with you.
Yeah. So you know, one of the things, as I'm reading your book, Zelda, I came to a point it's in the introduction of your book, at the end of the introduction of your book, where you write about your marriage and you write about betrayal.
Yes.
And I thought that here was something that could almost dominate the memoir, because you write about something many Black women have experienced, and that is the discovery that one's husband is bisexual. And I thought, okay, here's where I thought that you might explore marriage more deeply. I thought about at some one time we came through the thing in terms of the AIDS epidemic, where women were concerned about, you know, where's my husband? Who's he having sex with? And it became a very interesting issue. And I thought that I said, well, that's not going to be the center of your book. But I felt that there was a place where you could have said more about it.
Yeah, well, and when I was thinking about it, and believe it or not, I had 190 pages in my book, including the pictures, the collages. But when I actually finished writing the book, I had something like 300 to 400 pages. When I thought about it, I said, heck, nobody's going to read 300, 400 pages. So I took a whole lot of those things out that was referring to that particular topic, because then I think what happened writing about it gave me a sense of therapeutic release. And so I was able to let a lot of that stuff that was setting me on fire, I finally put it out. I put it to rest. But I had put it to rest before writing T, because I had gone through counseling. I had talked to people who had helped me get over it, if you will, to a degree. When I say get over it, you have to, well, for me, I had to learn how to let things go. Because if you keep all of that stuff in you, it can make you sick. And I did not want to be sick. I wanted to continue being vibrant. I wanted to be healthy. And I felt like writing T and letting, not putting all that stuff in there, was allowed me a sense of letting go and knowing that not betrayal not only happens to me, betrayal happens to everybody who lives in some form or fashion. Mine was just a bust in the head, excuse me, because I couldn't believe this was happening to me. I was like, this is impossible. But writing tea was a form, as I said, a form of therapy, letting go, learning how to commit to myself to do some other things.
And it seems like you also, I want to put words in your mouth, loving again.
Loving again. Oh, absolutely. Because I did after that. But I just, you know, and the element of time is so rewarding, if you will, because you have, well, for me, I have to put things into perspective.
Now talking about love, I got to interrupt you. Talking about love, Miyuki Williams is joining us. And so I love her. I'm saying that on the air. So Miyuki's there. And she's talk, Miyuki. I know you're going to help us raise some money. I can't see how much people have been pledging. I don't know. I don't have any.
It's okay. We've got, we want to thank a person who got us started. Lloyd from Katoha, New York, got us started. We have $500 to go for this hour. The number is 202-588-9739. Or if you go to WPFWFM.org and get the information. It is a fascinating discussion. Ms. Irby is really, really very interesting, really ensconced here in the history of of Washington, D.C., and as a poet and as a woman. And it's a great discussion. We want to get back to it. Ethelbert is the splendid interviewer and did so much research and asked all the great questions that we would ask if we could. Please, if you appreciate On the Margin, we have 13 minutes remaining, $500 to go. We can do it, but only with your help. This is powered, people-powered radio, so please do your part and support On Your Margin, Ethelbert Miller, and let's get back to the wonderful Zelda Irby, 202-588-9739.
Okay, thank you, Miyuki. Okay.
You know,
while we're here, I just two things I want you to talk about, because I think it's very, very important. You went to Federal City College, which also becomes UDC. Talk about that experience, who your teachers might have been, you know.
That was wonderful. I had challenged myself because I was determined to get my degree this time around, because I kept on messing around and I said, I've got to finish this. And there I go into school. I'm dressed, and because it was hot, it was still hot. It was in September, but there I go in my Jesus Christ wrapped up sandals up to my knees, some shorts, a T-tight shirt on, and I'm running late for my class. And I don't want to be late. And here's this gentleman standing in the hallway. And I'm saying, excuse me, sir. I said, I'm looking for Dr. Saunders' class. And he says, with this fabulous deep voice. He said, I am Dr. Sanders. And I'm like, oh, my goodness gracious. And 30 days later, we were married. And but during the course of the relationship, I kept saying to him, I said, isn't there something wrong with you dating me? I said, I'm your student. He said, well, I'm not aware of any of the rules that would stop me from marrying you. So I said, well, come on, let's do this. And we got married at lunchtime. And it was a wonderful experience. And Joe, God rest his soul, was a wonderful professor. I almost got my degree, but I didn't, because we had something
like you got your man, though.
Yeah, I got my man. For a minute, I had him. But it was wonderful. But people, we're so different and we're so unique. And that's the privilege, I think, one of the privileges of love, when you can find somebody and who loves you, that you love, and you can share that exchange with each other and make it last and make it whole. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, because I did it twice. Mm-hmm. And the third time I was going to do it, I said, I think I've got some experience. I'm going to leave this alone. I'm just going to date and have fun.
You know, if I'm not mistaken, there's a reference in your book, in the beginning of your book, to Sam Gilliam.
Oh, yeah. My art teacher from high school.
Talk about that.
He was so wonderful. And the thing that was so interesting about it, Sam, Mr. Gilliam, and I didn't like each other in the beginning. And I ended up babysitting his very first daughter. And I think she's either a lawyer or an attorney, one or the other. But his lovely wife, Dorothy, I think she's still here. But I ended up being their babysitter, because we formed a relationship. And that's what happens, I think, in our lives. People that you think that you may not like at the beginning, but something clicks between those individuals and a relationship is formed. Mr. Gilliam was one fantastic artist, and we stayed in touch all the way up until almost his death, because mm-hmm. he was my friend. He introduced me to Simi Knox, who was the portraitist who painted my father's portrait. And Simi now is got to be in his early 90s. And I don't know whether he's still painting or not, but he came to my home when I had a portrait, when I had paid a tribute to a famous Black man, my dad, for February, for Black History Month, when I was 47 years old, for my 47th Valentine birthday. And Simi came to my house. I introduced him to my family. He did meet my father. Unfortunately, Daddy passed before Daddy could see the finished product that Simi had painted of him. So I had Daddy's portrait right beside his coffin at his funeral service, because I wanted the family and the public to know that this is what Simi and I had been working on. And I still, of course, that portrait adorns my wall to this day and always will. Because
I was very happy that you mentioned Sam, because Sam was always my model of the elder, you know, what you were supposed to do.
Oh, yes.
I have like a Sam Gilliam here at home. You know, he was extremely generous.
He was.
His artwork, you know,
he even got me a scholarship at the Corcoran Gallery of Art. And I decided to do something else. He said, Zola, he said, you want to be an artist? He said, I've shown you the different techniques and you've taken on these techniques. And then I diverted and did something else. But he was a wonderful, not only art teacher, but he was a wonderful human being. And of course, he became world renowned artist, because his convictions of himself, of what he wanted to do, was strong, and it took him all the way.
So no, and I'm looking at Miyuki right now. We're talking about Sam Gilliam. She has a Jacob Lawrence behind her. Did you want to make a final pitch, Miyuki?
I did. I just wanted to thank Beverly very much for contributing to On the Margin. Folks, we only have $450 to go. One person can knock that out, become a sustainer. Two people doing $20 a month, and we will attain the goal. This has been a wonderful, wonderful journey through old D.C. We're talking about Tina Rama and Sam Gilliam and the Corcoran Gallery of Art and the different ways that Ms. Irby views life, including I'll marry twice and I'll have fun from the rest of the life. But it's just a great, again, Ethelbert does so well in having these conversations that are so engaging, so insightful, and really want you to, you know, go learn more about the person and get a book or go see them perform or something. And if you appreciate that, if you understand that each show has to reach its goal in order for WPFW to reach its overall goal, do call 1-800-222-9739 or grab Cash App. Cash App is $WPFWFM. And our website, our wonderful website, maybe you're using our radio app to listen to this, but just go to donate now and give as generously as you can. Make sure that Ethelbert gets the affirmation that he deserves, that he does a great show, that you appreciate it, and this is your opportunity to affirm the fact that you appreciate his work. Thank you so much.
And everyone should have that WPFW app on their phone right now.
Yeah, by now they should. But meanwhile, we want them to go and make a pledge for Ethelbert and Ethelbert Miller and Zelda Irby and On the Margin and WPFW. Please, we need $450 to make this goal.
Okay. Do I have like could I ask one more question?
Sure.
Okay. I'm going to ask you one more question. You know, you had this desire to go to Tanzania. You know, you were talking about that. Your wish. Okay. Oh, 1 minute. You went to South Africa quickly.
Oh, God, yes.
Okay.
I encourage
everybody to go to South Africa.
Oh, yes. That was fabulous.
All right. Okay.
I loved being in South Africa was a wonderful experience. And my mother was concerned because she said, when I got back home and I said, Mom, I said, South Africa is fabulous. She said, don't tell me anything about you moving to South Africa.
Said, all right. Well, we're going to end on that. No, we're going to keep you here. We're going to keep here in the neighborhood. Okay.
But it was wonderful.
Okay. Well, you were wonderful today. I want to thank you, Zelda Collier Irby. Thank you for being my guest on The Margin. That's the end of our show of On The Margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller, station is WPFW 89.3 FM.
Hi there. This is Tata from Rhizome DC. I want to tell you about an important exhibit that's on the view at the MLK Library through December. It's about artist-run, non-commercial DIY spaces in the district, covering history from the 70s to today. On the weekend of October 18th and 19th, we will activate the exhibit with the DIY in DC Festival, featuring music, workshops, participatory movement, pozole, healing sounds for your house plants, important conversations with bright local artists and organizers. Details on rhizomedc.org.
This Saturday, October 18th, from 8 a.m. until 6 p.m., WPFW combines music and message by integrating coverage of the 30th anniversary of the Million Man March and No Kings DC rally into your favorite Saturday music lineup. We'll offer cutaways from both events, as well as go live to the No Kings rally from noon until 2 p.m. Jazz and justice at its finest on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Good news, family. You can now take WPFW everywhere you go with our brand new WPFW radio app. Stream Jazz and Justice live, listen to archived shows, view the program schedule and playlists, donate, and more, all right from your phone. Download the WPFW radio app today from Apple App or Google Play Stores. WPFW in your pocket. Jazz and Justice wherever you are.
Hey, DC, we're reigniting the spirit of unity in our community beginning Monday, October 13th through Saturday, October 19th, by commemorating the 30th anniversary of the Million Man March and UniFest, two iconic events that shaped our history and continue to inspire our future. Events include prayer calls, a torch run, a lantern peace walk, a recommitment service, and a mini UniFest at Union Temple Baptist Church. This is an opportunity to honor the past and build bridges for a united future for our children and families, reviving the values of the Million Man March and UniFest. Details at UnionTempleDC.com.
On Wednesday, October 22nd, WPFW presents Justice, Inclusion, and Dignity in a Free Congo our second annual day of emancipatory, informational, and inspirational programming centering Congolese sovereignty and decolonization, during which we explore all things Congo. From 5 a.m. until midnight, we'll present voices from the front lines in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, creating a unique opportunity to hear from those involved in movement building and grassroots organizing across the DRC, in addition to poetry, speeches, and music. That's Justice, Inclusion, and Dignity in a Free Congo, Wednesday, October 22nd, 5 a.m. until midnight on WPFW. Building a more equitable world, one broadcast at a time.
Are you ready? The Birchmere presents Keiko Matsui, November 2nd, and Macy Gray, November 5th. Details at birchmere.com.